conference room. The topic was one very close to Frankfurter's heart. He was explaining the difference between a true immigrant patriot, someone who had become a citizen and loved his country above all else, and a fundamentally disloyal immigrant, one who subscribed fully to the beliefs of the Communist Party and took the oath of naturalization in bad faith, in the hopes of undermining the country that had welcomed him to its shores. The villain of the piece was one William Schneiderman, whose case was being heard by the court for a second time. Schneiderman, a Jew by birth, had come to the United States from Russia as a boy of two, and had been raised in Chicago and later Los Angeles, in circumstances of dire poverty. He had joined the Young Workers League at 16, and the Workers' Party, predecessor to the Communist Party USA, at 18. At 21, he had been naturalized as a citizen. By that time, he had become a committed communist, rising to the rank of secretary of the party in California. Schneiderman believed U.S. citizenship was perfectly consistent with communist belief, but the government disagreed. After a disgruntled former communist denounced him to the House Un-American Activities Committee, the federal government tried to strip Schneiderman of his citizenship. He had been a citizen for 12 years. But the government reasoned that as a communist he could not have taken the oath of naturalization without lying, since he must logically be a disbeliever in organized government, who was devoted to the overthrow of the U.S. government by force and violence. The foil to Schneiderman was Frankfurter himself. Frankfurter was the only justice who had immigrated. He was the only one to have had his citizenship impugned at his confirmation hearings, and he was the only one to have been asked at those hearings whether he was or ever had been a communist. The superficial similarities between his experiences and Schneiderman's impelled him to differentiate the two of them. He had known innocent fellow travelers, Frankfurter told the other justices, and Schneiderman was no innocent. He was the real thing, a dangerous traitor, whose citizenship should be revoked. Frankfurter had special competence on the subject, he maintained, not only because he had known many radicals in his lifetime, but because he, too, was an immigrant. He spoke of his own naturalization as a conversion. Loyalty to the Constitution, he said, was his religion. And it is well known that a convert is more zealous than one born to the faith. Indeed, Frankfurter suggested, Americanism had replaced Judaism in his spiritual life. As one who has no ties with any formal religion, perhaps the feelings that underlie religious forms for me run into intensification of my feelings about American citizenship. Such citizenship was, he said, a fellowship which binds people together by devotion to certain feelings and ideas and ideals. These could be summarized as a requirement that they be attached to the principles of the Constitution. Schneiderman was not attached to those principles. Therefore, he was no true citizen. The conditions of loyalty had not been met. Ultimately, Frankfurter's colleagues did not agree with his assessment of Schneiderman. The Soviet Union was by then allied with the United States against Hitler, and although the court's opinion protested that there was no connection, it was not an opportune time for the country to be stripping communists of their citizenship. The court held that because Schneiderman had been a law-abiding citizen for 5 years after taking the oath, his citizenship remained valid, and Frankfurter joined a dissenting opinion by Chief Justice Stone. But the significance of Frankfurter's protestations on the subject of loyalty were important for another reason. He was being subjected to almost unbearable pressure to admit that he had been wrong in the case of the Jehovah's Witnesses and their refusal to salute the flag. The claim was being based not simply on the principles of liberalism, but on his Jewish origin. When Frankfurter had written the opinion, ruling that towns could require children to salute, it had seemed like a patriotic decision. As a Jew, he had been especially concerned that children not be treated differently in schools on the basis of religion. Since then, the politics had shifted. The United States was now at war with Nazi Germany, a country whose policies were aimed precisely at suppressing a religious minority. To liberals, tolerance, not saluting, had become the American form of patriotism. Even the previously innocuous-seeming form of the salute, with the right arm extended straight ahead, palm up, was now perceived as too similar to the Nazis' straight-armed, palm-down, Heil Hitler. In the spring of 1942, in a case that involved the Jehovah's Witnesses' right to be exempt from a tax on the distribution of pamphlets, Black, Douglas, and Frank Murphy had filed a highly unusual dissent, openly regretting their earlier votes in the flag salute case. Then, a year later, the court overturned Frankfurter's earlier judgment, the first time the Roosevelt Court had reversed itself. The opinion, elegantly written by Jackson, became an instant classic, famous as much for its aphorisms as its holding. Jackson had not been on the court when the first flag salute case was decided, but he had told Frankfurter that he strongly disagreed with his opinion. Now he embraced Stone's argument in his original dissent that the goal of judicial review was to protect minorities. The very purpose of the Bill of Rights, he wrote, was to withdraw certain subjects from the vicissitudes of political controversy, to place them beyond the reach of majorities and officials, and to establish them as legal principles to be applied by the courts. Fundamental rights may not be submitted to a vote. They depend on the outcome of no elections. Jackson's opinion also made it clear that he understood the political symbolism involved in protecting free speech for all, not just the religious liberty of the witnesses. In particular, Jackson wrote, the children were being protected against having to declare a belief which they did not hold. If there is any fixed star in our constitutional constellation, it is that no official, high or petty, can prescribe what shall be orthodox in politics, nationalism, religion, or other matters of opinion, or force citizens to confess by word or act their faith therein. Frankfurter took the reversal of his Gobitis opinion as a professional and personal calamity. It was bad enough that the court had rejected the philosophy of judicial restraint, on which he had built his reputation, but it was much worse that the court was using the flag salute as a metaphor for the Nazis' oppression of Jews. Frankfurter's birthplace and childhood home were now under Nazi control. He believed that he had voted in favor of equal treatment for all, regardless of religion. Now he was being told that as a Jew, he had made a mistake. Not only his jurisprudence, but his selfhood was on the line. Frankfurter responded with the most agonized and agonizing opinion recorded anywhere in the U.S. reports. Over weeks, Frankfurter compiled pages upon pages of disjointed arguments in his barely decipherable longhand. When circulating a draft could no longer be avoided, his law clerk, Philip Ellman, who would later play a key role in the famous desegregation decision, Brown versus Board of Education, strung Frankfurter's notes together over a single, long night at the typewriter. In the morning, Frankfurter circulated the unedited draft to the other justices.